Now, I want to begin today with a little bit of review, and that is the question, what is a covenant? Because this section of Scripture is talking very much about a covenant. We're talking about that last time, what is a covenant? And it is to place, the word covenant comes from the meaning to place between two. To place between two. Two parties, therefore there is relationship, there is the need, the desire for relationship, and a covenant is something that is placed between two. So it's kind of like a contract or a will. It also has the idea of an arrangement to behave in a certain manner. A good word for this is disposition. With that arrangement between two, it is the agreement saying, this is how I will be towards you. This is how I will behave towards you. This is my disposition towards you. And so we've been talking about how God had a change in disposition. God's disposition toward us has changed. Here's the problem. Some people might think, well, God just changed his mind. God didn't just change his mind and say, okay, now I have a new disposition towards you. There is a basis to this new disposition that he has toward us. Remember, in the Old Testament, a major emphasis of the Old Testament was separation between a holy God and sinful man. Whereas in the New Testament, the major emphasis is reconciliation between holy God and sinful man. That God has done the work to redeem us, to bring us back to himself. What is the basis for the change in this disposition? Well, it's what we find in verse 26, at the end of verse 26. Christ, the word he is a reference to Christ, has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. He has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now, what the writer of Hebrews is offering us here in this section, particularly chapter 7, 8, and 9, and particularly here in chapter 9, is a historical context. Clear that even the readers of his day didn't have a full grasp of the significance of all the sacrifices that were offered in the Old Testament. Because when you look at the Levitical sacrificial system, the Levitical priesthood, and the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, lots of sacrifices, lots of rituals, massive amounts of blood shed in these sacrifices. And we can sit here today, having experienced and having had the benefits of grace for all of these years, almost 2,000 years now, and we're so far removed from that, and that seems like such ancient history, and we can think, why do we need all this history? Why do I even need to bother to read the Old Testament? It's just so old, and it's so far removed from me. What does this have to do with me? Let me encourage you to understand the Old Testament in this way. If there's two things that we learn from the Old Testament, one is the holiness of God, and number two is the sinfulness of man. The holiness of God and the sinfulness of man. Now, in the New Testament, now being under this age of grace, after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, if we take grace for granted, if we just become so used to it and so complacent in it, if we take it for granted, then we have the tendency to diminish the holiness of God and to minimize the vile destructiveness of sin. How many people today say, well, you know, I'm not that bad of a person? That is exactly what the Old Testament teaches us is not true. Sin is vile and it is destructive. And we cannot forget that. A couple of things here to just illustrate this. The holiness of God and the sinfulness of man. If God is a gallon jug of pure distilled water, nothing impure at all. Scriptures tell us that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. God dwells in unapproachable light, it says. If you were to take that gallon of distilled pure water and you were to take one little drop of a very, very powerful poison called ricin, take one tiny little drop and just drop it in that gallon of water, is that water pure anymore? It's not. You see, you cannot take absolute purity and the most minuscule amount of impurity and maintain purity. But see, the problem is God made us so that we can enjoy Him, so that we can be with Him and fellowship with Him. There's the problem. His holiness can also be seen in this sense. God is a consuming fire, and this is what Hebrews tells us in chapter 12. God is a consuming fire. His holiness consumes everything that is contrary to His character and His purpose, which are both perfect, absolutely perfect. And His holiness is such that He will consume anything that is contrary to it. It's like somebody deciding to travel to the sun. Supposing we could. Supposing we could discover a way to travel faster than the speed of light, and we can get to the sun in, let's say, a week. Okay? It takes 8 months just to get to Mars right now, you understand, right? But let's say we can get to the sun, and somebody says, I'm going to travel to the sun. How close do you think they'd be able to get? Not very close at all. They would be absolutely consumed by the heat of the sun. And so is the holiness of God. If we are going to be anywhere near Him and be able to enjoy Him, then the essence of our nature needs to be of the same purity as His, so that we can commune with Him and fellowship with Him. Do you see the problem there? And the Old Testament teaches us and reminds us of how absolutely holy and pure God is, but it also teaches us and reminds us of our own sinfulness. And the two can't mix. There's the problem. And that's why in the Old Testament a major emphasis was separation, the necessary separation between holy God and sinful man. This is why we have this historical context. This is why the Levitical sacrificial system. This is how we need to understand the Old Testament. So let's make sure that, one, we don't take grace for granted. Two, we do not diminish the holiness of God. And three, we don't minimize our own sinfulness. We have lots of different words and names and titles and labels for sin today, don't we? But the Bible just simply calls it that, sin. Genesis chapter 2:17, as God was talking to Adam and Eve in the garden, He says, you can have everything in this garden, but you see that tree in the middle, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? He says, you can't touch that. Stay away from that tree. You can't have it. I don't want that for you. Adam and Eve can have everything else. And God says, in the day that you eat of it, finish it with me, you shall surely die. You shall surely die. Why? Because eating that would mean that they then would rebel against God, thinking they know better, and they then would do something that is contrary to the character and purpose of God, and God would necessarily have to remove them from Himself. When God said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die, it's not just a vengeful attitude. God was saying, this is something that must happen. If you do anything that is contrary to my character and purpose, I can't have you near me. Because God has absolute, perfect holiness and purity. So we need to define sin, because that's exactly what they did. That was the beginning of it there. And that sin passed on to you and me. And we're born with that. So let's be careful to define sin here. So many people have a whole list of all these things are all sins. And everybody has a different list. What we need to do is just give it a very simple definition. So understand this, okay? What is sin? Sin is any thought or behavior. Any thought or behavior. So you see, sin isn't just behavior. It starts in the mind. Sin originates in the mind of the created being. Sin is any thought or behavior that is contrary to the perfect character and purpose of God. Any thought or behavior that is contrary to the perfect character and purpose of God. And what we need to understand about ourselves is that sin isn't just something that has infected me, and therefore there's a part of me that's sick. Sin isn't just a part of who we are. Every aspect of my being and of your being has been marred and poisoned by this vileness. Every aspect. Not just physically. Intellectually. your mind has been affected, infected by the vile destructiveness of sin. And therefore your thought patterns, your emotions, your intellect, all of that poisoned by the vileness of sin, and particularly spiritually, we have the problem of death, spiritual death, being separated from God. Look at it this way. If life is a computer, then sin is a virus that destroys the hard drive. The whole computer is affected by it. Every function of the computer is affected by it. Every function that you and I can do, beginning with thought and desire and emotion, every function is impacted by sin. Sin is vile and destructive and poisoning, and if not dealt with absolutely, it will keep reproducing. It will keep reproducing, and therein lies the problem. You want to know something interesting? Your children are a reproduction of the sin nature. You're thinking, oh, so that's what's wrong with my kids. Your children are a reproduction of the sin nature. Don't get too excited, because you're somebody else's child too, aren't you, right? So you also are a reproduction of the sin nature. Sin does to us what passion for the ring did to Smeagol. Remember in Lord of the Rings? Sin does to us what passion for the ring did to Smeagol and turned him into Gollum. That's exactly what it does. And so the Lord said, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. So we need to understand what the definition of death is. What does death mean in the context of what God has said? When Adam and Eve ate that fruit, did they just keel over and die on the ground physically? No, they didn't. They did die, however, because in the day that they ate of it, their something became necessary. What was that something? It was separation. So understand this. Death and separation are synonymous in terms in the Scriptures. Death and separation. Because death is separation. And ultimately, death is separation from God, from the source and sustainer of life. Look at it this way. Remember the tree and the tree branch? You've got a tree, and out from that tree grows a branch. Where does that branch get its sustenance? Where does that branch get its life? From the tree. If that branch were to sever itself from the tree, it would lie on the ground, and to begin with, it might look like it's alive. It might still have some green leaves on it, but is it alive? It is not. It is dying a very slow death. It cannot produce. It cannot grow. It cannot do what it was designed to do. It cannot function according to design. Why? Because it is dead. It has severed itself from the very source of life. And that's what death is. And the Lord says to Adam and Eve, in the day that you eat of it, in the day that you walk away from me, in the day that you declare your independence from me, in the day that you tell me that you think you know better, and that you can find your satisfaction in something other than me, in that day, you will surely die. You will be separated from me. I, your source and sustainer of life. You will be a dead tree branch on the ground, severed from the tree. In the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. The Scriptures tell us the wages of sin is death. And you may say, man, isn't that pretty severe of God? Well, let's back up there. You know, what does that statement reflect? What did I say before? What's the warning for us believers? We take grace for granted, and we minimize the holiness of God, and we diminish the vile destructiveness of sin. Out of that thought pattern will come the statement, isn't that kind of mean of God to do that? What are we doing? We're diminishing the holiness of God and minimizing the vile destructiveness of sin. You see, the severity of the crime is relative and measured by the one against whom it is committed. Let me give you this illustration. This was given to a junior high class. I think it's pretty good. It kind of illustrates it. Suppose a middle school student punches another student in the class. What happens? The student gets detention. Suppose during the detention the boy punches the teacher. What happens? The student gets suspended. Suppose on the way home the same boy punches a policeman in the nose. What happens? The boy goes to jail. Suppose a little while later he gets out of jail and he's standing in a crowd along the road and the president is going to be walking by, the president of the United States, and the boy lunges out to punch the president in the face. What happens? Well, before he gets close enough to the president, the Secret Service takes him out. You see, all of the crimes are the same, just punching somebody in the face, but the severity of the crime is measured by the person who is committed against. And the crime is against an infinite holy God. Our crime is against an infinite holy God. Now, Rich, why are you saying all this? Because this is what the Old Testament teaches us. This is why we have the Old Testament. Yes, we are in the New Testament. We are under grace. But we can never forget. We can never forget that the grace of God is grace because of the absolute holiness of God and the vile destructiveness of our sin. And our crime is against an infinite holy God. We cannot forget that. And the sacrificial system of the Old Testament reminded the people of exactly that. So we've got two things at odds here. Two things at odds that require a covenant. First of all, what is at odds is the requirement of wrath. When God said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die, meaning when you practice sin and then sin becomes a part of your experience and your nature, then you have to stay away from me. That's wrath. Sin requires necessarily the wrath of God. And you say, Rich, why do you say that? Because let me ask you this. If God is absolutely good, wouldn't it logically follow that if he is absolutely perfectly good, that he would want to destroy that which destroys? Yes. So God necessarily must pour out his wrath on sin and say, keep it away. Stay away. What do you do for your computer to keep viruses out of it? You have all kinds of protection. You put up firewalls. You say, keep out of my computer. And God does what is necessary to keep sin away from his perfect holiness. Why? Because anytime we come anywhere close to him, we would be utterly consumed. So this is what's at odds. The requirement of his wrath. God says, away with it. Away with it. God says, I must destroy that which destroys what is good. Some of you have and are battling cancer. What do we do with cancer cells? We do everything we can to do what? To destroy the cancer cells. Radiation. Chemotherapy. What do? We target those cancer cells to destroy them. Why? Because what are those cancer cells doing? They're destroying the body. They're destroying every function of the body. So what do? We make every effort we can to destroy the cancer. That's the necessary wrath of God. Because he is a good God. So what's at odds here? First of all, is the requirement of God's wrath. Away with it. But that then, the requirement of God's wrath is at odds with his desire, his very purpose for our creation. What is the purpose of my existence? It is to know God, is to fellowship with him. That is God's desire. God wants me. God wants you. He wants you to fellowship with him. He wants you to enjoy him. But do you see what's at odds here? The requirement of his wrath and the desire of his fellowship with you and yours with him. Those two are at odds. On one sense, in his wrath, God says, away with it. And at odds with that, God says his desire is, come to me. How does he deal with that? This is why God needs a covenant. There needs to be an arrangement between the two. And that's what the old covenant was. Because that is true, nothing but death can atone for sin. Nothing but death can atone for sin. Remember, the severity of the crime is measured by the person whom it is committed against. Nothing but death can atone for sin. When it says, without remission of blood, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. The shedding of blood is just a statement that means the forfeiture of life. The forfeiture of physical life. It has to be given up. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. So the word atone, then, means to cover. Because the penalty for sin is death. So that's what you have then in the Old Testament, in the Old Testament sacrificial system. All of that was a pointer to the perfect sacrifice that would come in Jesus Christ. The penalty for sin is death, the required forfeiture of life, the required separation. And in the Old Testament, the atonement would adequately deal with sin to allow temporary forbearance of a holy God so that he can interact with sinful man. Temporary forbearance. This leads us then to the necessity of a covenant. And you can look once again at Hebrews chapter 9, verses 18 to 22. And it describes how that first covenant was inaugurated, was initiated, was brought about, was launched through the shedding of blood, and Moses did that. And then the blood sacrifices continued. The forfeiture of life continued. The requirement of a covenant was necessary to come between the requirement of God's wrath and the desire of His fellowship, that we would fellowship with Him. Those two things are at odds. Therefore, it required a covenant, so that there could be the disposition of God to be able to interact with His people. Meanwhile, sin had to be atoned for. So then in the Old Testament system, God could fellowship with people on the basis of sprinkled blood. Sprinkled blood. Now think about this for a minute. What does sprinkled blood mean? I already said it one time before. Sprinkled blood. If somebody sheds blood, we even use the phrase today, shedding of blood. Bloodshed. What does that refer to? It refers to death. It refers to death. It refers to the separation of the spirit of man from the body of man. That there is a death, that there is a separation there. And sprinkled blood in the Old Testament, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't human blood. It was animal blood. But it was life nonetheless. It was the forfeiture of life. This created being has to give up its life in order to atone for the sinfulness and the necessary wrath of a holy God. That was the old covenant. That was the sacrificial system. And all of that was pointing to the one final ultimate sacrifice that would be made, the one final ultimate forfeiture of life that would be made by the perfect spotless Lamb. You see, in the Old Testament, there were massive amounts of blood shed. But all of it was just simply the giving up of life, the forfeiture of life, because of the necessary requirement of God's wrath. And under that system, it could not offer permanent remedy to the problem. It could only offer temporary forbearance. Because it was forfeiture of life, it was shed blood, but it was created blood of a creature, but it was animal life. And God said, I'm just using this as a temporary substitute, a temporary forbearance. It did not fully deal with the problem. It was intended to point to what would and what did fully deal with the vile, destructive problem of sin. And so we understand then from this text in Hebrews chapter 9 that only one thing could ultimately satisfy the necessary wrath of God. Only one thing could ultimately satisfy the necessary wrath of God. And that's where we have the statement in verse 26. He, Christ, has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself, by the forfeiture of his own life. And that's exactly what Christ did. Remember when Jesus was walking towards the Jordan River and John the Baptist was there and he saw the Christ and he recognized him and he said, "Behold what? The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." The perfect spotless Lamb. Now, understand who we're dealing with here. This was Jesus the Christ, the second person of the Godhead. The one who is your creator and mine. He left his glory. He came to us looking just like one of us in human form born of a woman. Okay? So he had a body. He had blood flowing in his veins. And he came to us for one specific purpose. Why did God give him a body? So that that body could be nailed to a cross. The shedding of blood. The forfeiture of life. And that's what Christ did. With his own blood. He didn't enter now the holy place because Christ isn't in a holy place here on earth. He's seated at the right hand of the throne of majesty on high. He's in the very presence of God in heaven as we speak. And he entered there. Remember what our high priest does? He intercedes for me in the presence of God to guarantee the ultimate promise based on the ultimate sacrifice. He walked into the Holy of Holies, the very presence of God, with his own blood. On the basis of the fact that he had forfeited his own life. With his own blood. Now, listen, this is... It's speaking of the forfeiture of his life. That he laid down his life, that he gave up his life. He didn't walk into heaven with a bowl of his own blood, okay? It just says it means that he gave up his life. Now, what is the significance of that? Remember when Jesus was on the cross? Probably the most memorable statement that he made. It was in the middle of the day. The sun turned dark. The earth quaked. And Jesus said, my God, why have you, what? Forsaken me. Folks, listen, that's something you and I will never understand. God is Godhead. His Trinity is three persons. Eternal, perfect relationship with each other. And the second person of the Trinity, hanging on a cross, cried out to the first person of the Godhead, and he said, why have you forsaken me? What is that? That is separation. That was the death necessary. God had to turn his back on his son because, as the scriptures say, he became sin for us. As he took upon himself all of your sin and mine, what is the requirement of God? God necessarily had to say, away with him. Go away. And Jesus at that moment felt the abject loneliness and despair and death that our vile, destructive sin deserves. That's what atoned for you and me. That's what redeems you and me. Why is it significant? Because it says he offered himself without spot. What is the significance of that? This life that was forfeited was infinitely perfect. It wasn't the blood of an animal. It wasn't even the blood of another mere human being. He could have been a great man. He could have been the greatest man. He could have been the most moral man. He could have been the male embodiment of Mother Teresa. But it wouldn't have worked. The only thing that could atone perfectly and absolutely for your sin and mine is the forfeiture of infinite perfection, a life of infinite perfection. Why? To match the holiness of the one against whom we have sinned. With his own blood, without spot. Do you see the significance of this then? Remember the night before that he died, the night that he was betrayed, Jesus sat with his disciples and he took the cup. They were celebrating the Passover. And he said, "This cup is the blood of the covenant. This is the new covenant in my blood." Jesus was just as much saying, "This is my shed blood. This is what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm going to lay down my life. I'm going to forfeit my life." And he knew at that moment, folks, that his Father would have to turn his back on him. He knew at that moment that he would have to experience the abject loneliness and despair that our sin deserves. And he said, "This is the new covenant in my blood." That is the arrangement. That's what comes. That is what placed between the two of us, the holy God and we as sinful, vile people. What is between us and the holy God? It is the forfeiture of this perfect life. He took our sin upon him so that his righteousness could be made ours. Then that is the covenant. This is the new covenant in my blood. This changes God's disposition towards me because it says he put away sin. That means forgiveness is now possible. I can now be reconciled to God because the requirement of his wrath has been met. And all of it was focused upon this one, Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 24, verse 46 records for us that when Jesus, after his resurrection, he was walking on the road to Emmaus. And he was telling them that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer. It was necessary for the Christ to die. Why is this? We find this in verses 16 and 17. It says, "A will, a testament, is only in force after the one who made it dies." So God was saying, perfect, holy, infinite God was saying to us vile, poisoned, destructive sinners encompassed by this vile destructiveness of sin, God says to us, "I want you to come to me. I want you to be drawn to me. I want you to love me, your ultimate satisfaction. I want you to enjoy me through your fellowship with me. I am your highest good." And that will become possible through the death of this one. This perfect life that was forfeited because of my necessary wrath. So what was satisfied here? Remember what I said was at odds? The requirement of God's wrath and the desire of his desire of our fellowship with him. Those two things are at odds. But he satisfied this requirement in Jesus Christ. He destroyed what destroys the vile destructiveness of sin. He put away sin, it says in verse 26. The annulment, the removal. That word "put away" means the annulment, the removal of. Got it out of the way so that there's no longer an obstruction between sinful man and holy God. Because the covenant, the new covenant, is there. But it also satisfied God's desire, his purpose. his desire that God and man be in fellowship. Therefore, it is on this basis. It is on this basis that God and man can fellowship and commune. This is God's new disposition toward us, that we be made right, that we are right before him, that we can be reconciled to him. The statement eternal redemption in verse 12 means that we are liberated to pursue him, because that's what we were created for. And the whole paragraph concludes with verse 28, which speaks of the ultimate triumph of Christ over all vile sin and its destructive consequences, that he returns to completely restore his creation. So what does our high priest do? Well, the instrumentalist is going to come forward now and get ready for our closing song. I want us to review what our high priest does for us. We can never forget this, folks. What does my high priest do? Would you read this with me? He intercedes for me in the presence of God to guarantee the ultimate promise based on his ultimate sacrifice. It's time for us now to celebrate our great high priest. An absolutely beautiful, wonderful song to go along with this. All I have is Christ. Would you stand now and sing that with me?